Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take a complex topic, slice through the noise, and give you the comprehensive, essential understanding you need. Today, we're unraveling the secret life of, well, probably the most common piece of technology in your pocket, the telephone. It's a device so integrated into, you know, the fabric of modern existence that we rarely stop to analyze its function or its incredible history. At its most fundamental level, the telephone is beautifully simple. It's a telecommunications device that allows two people to have a conversation when they're just too far apart to be heard directly. The word itself tells the whole story, doesn't it? It comes straight from ancient Greek. Tile, meaning far, and phonio, meaning voice. The distant voice. Simple concept. But the journey from that conceptual definition to the slick all-in-one supercomputer we carry today is, well, it's not simple at all. It's a 150-year-long winding road full of technological leaps, bitter lawsuits, and some truly surprising historical detours along the way.
And that is our mission for you today. We're going to trace that evolution, charting the telephone's path from a controversial, experimental 19th century invention right up to the dominant integrated computing device it is now. We want to extract the key technological insights, the real breakthrough moments that change everything, and make sure you walk away understanding not just, you know, who invented it, but really how it evolved. And here's the initial spark of knowledge, the aha moment we want you to hold on to right from the start. The credit for the electric telephone is intensely disputed. It stretches far beyond the single name you likely associate with it, and maybe even more surprising. The very first devices actually called telephones didn't use any electricity at all. We're going to begin with the era of communication using pure acoustic power. We're talking highly engineered megaphones and speaking tubes. Seriously.
Okay, let's unpack that immediately because, yeah, the story of the telephone doesn't start with a wire. It starts with this core concept of the distant voice. So let's dive into section one, the disputed origins and the master patent.
It's really crucial to understand that the term telephone was already floating around the scientific community decades before Alexander Graham Bell ever filed a patent. It was just applied to much more primitive, purely acoustic concepts first. Take, for example, Gottfried Huth's telephone back in 1796.
1796, okay.
Yeah. This wasn't electric, obviously, and it wasn't exactly successful, but it was trying to solve that problem of distance.
Yeah.
Huth proposed this as an alternative to the optical telegraphy systems of the time.
Which relied on visual signals, like semaphore arms.
Exactly. Complex visual signals. Huth's idea was simpler. In theory, build massive speaking tubes or megaphones so operators in signaling towers could literally shout the message to the next station. The idea was to speed up the process compared to moving those signal arms.
Just shout across the landscape. It really shows the desperation for faster communication, doesn't it? And this need wasn't just on land. We see it at sea, too. Captain John Taylor developed a device in 1844.
That used four large acoustic air horns.
Yeah, essential for communication between sailing vessels, particularly when fog or bad weather reduced visibility.
So again, it's a distant voice system relying purely on the force of air, not electricity, just acoustics.
Which takes us right to the heart of the controversy, the race to transmit voice electrically.
This is where the modern story truly begins. And where the claim of invention just splinters among many brilliant minds. You've got Charles Boussole, Antonio Meucci, Johann Philipp Reis, Alexander Graham Bell, Elisha Gray, all playing crucial roles and all credited in various accounts for laying the foundation. It's messy.
But if we're looking for maybe the first genuine attempt at converting sound into recognizable electrical impulses, the figure often unfairly minimized is Johann Philipp Reis.
That's a good point. Around 1860, he created a working device, which he also called a telephone. And it really does appear to be the first system based on that sound-to-electrical conversion principle. Reis was an innovator. He demonstrated his device publicly in 1861 before the Physical Society of Frankfurt. He didn't just create the device. He formally coined and popularized the term telephone in the context of electrical communication.
And what's fascinating about Reis is the specific transmission he chose to demonstrate it. It wasn't a greeting or a command, was it?
No. He used this German non sequitur, presumably to test the fidelity of his mechanism. Das Pferd frisst keinen Gurkensalat.
Which means?
The horse does not eat cucumber salad.
Okay. Why that?
It sounds absurd, but that line is actually a historical milestone. It demonstrated the possibility of transmitting something recognizable as human speech electrically. However, his device was still pretty rudimentary. Sources say it often failed to reproduce speech clearly. It seemed to rely more on intermittent currents.
Like a telegraph signal.
Yeah.
On-off clicks.
Kind of. Which made the voice sound more like buzzing or clicking. Closer to coded messages than smooth speech.
Yeah.
So sound transmission, yes. Intelligible voice. not quite consistently.
Okay, and then there's Antonio Meucci.
Yes, we absolutely have to talk about Meucci. Many sources credit him with developing a voice communication apparatus, maybe even earlier, perhaps as early as 1849, in Staten Island, New York. He understood the need to formalize his work, and in December 1871, he filed something called a patent caveat in the U.S. Patent Office. He titled it Sound Telegraph.
Now, for listeners who might not know, can you explain what a patent caveat is and why it was so crucial, yet ultimately, well, didn't secure the invention for Meucci?
Sure. A caveat isn't a full patent award. It's basically a temporary legal notice of intent. It told the patent office, look, I am working on this invention, and I plan to file a full patent application soon. Meucci's caveat lasted for 2 years initially, providing some protection while he tried to find financing to actually develop and patent it properly. But crucially, when he failed to secure the necessary funds, and the fee wasn't huge, but it was significant for him, he didn't renew the caveat. It simply lapsed in 1874.
And that economic footnote, just not having the cash for the renewal fee, fundamentally altered telecommunications history. It left the door wide open for Alexander Graham Bell and his financial backers just 2 years later.
Indeed it did. Which brings us squarely to Bell. He was the first to be granted the key U.S. patent, that's U.S. patent 174,465, in March 1876. And while others had certainly transmitted sound, Bell's specific claim, the one that held up legally and commercially, was for a device that produced a clearly intelligible replication of the human voice. That distinction, clear, understandable replication, is really what his commercial empire was built upon.
But what was the specific technical breakthrough that allowed for that clarity? You mentioned Race and others used intermittent currents, making the sound choppy, almost like telegraph clicks. What did Bell figure out that they missed?
This is the genius of Bell's work, really. And it's the core technical difference. Earlier devices tried to use electrical pulses that only corresponded to the presence or absence of sound, like an on-off switch. Or they used currents that broke contact. These couldn't capture the subtle, continuous variations of the human voice. Bell discovered that to reproduce sound accurately, you needed a fluctuating current. He defined it as an undulating current.
Undulating, like a wave. Smooth changes.
Precisely. This fluctuating current continuously varied its intensity and frequency exactly in proportion to the air pressure changes caused by the sound waves hitting the transmitter. It's essentially the principle of what we now call amplitude modulation, or AM. This realization, this specific type of current, was the basis for his master patent. It became the foundation upon which the entire electric telephone industry was constructed.
And that fluctuating, undulating current insight is what led to that famous first successful transmission of clear speech using a liquid transmitter on March 10, 1876. The words, of course, everyone knows them. Mr. Watson, come here, I want to see you. That single phrase marked the true birth of reproducible, intelligible voice communication over a wire.
But here's the critical post-invention problem.
Yeah.
Okay, the technology proved you could connect point A to point B. Great. But what if you wanted to connect point A to B, C, D, E, F, and maybe G and H too? You quickly realize you absolutely cannot run dedicated pairs of wires between every single potential subscriber in a city.
Right. The wiring would become an impossible spaghetti monster. The system needed to scale somehow.
Exactly. And that organizational challenge, that scaling problem, is where the infrastructure side of the story begins. Mm-hmm. Almost immediately after Bell's patent was granted, the focus had to shift from pure invention to network engineering. And it was a Hungarian engineer, Tudor Puskas, who proposed the essential solution, the telephone switch or exchange.
The central hub idea.
Yes. This invention allowed for the formation of centralized telephone exchanges and networks. It was an absolutely mandatory step that turned the telephone from, you know, a scientific curiosity or a toy for the rich into a potential public utility.
Which brings us nicely into section two. Early commercial instruments and system infrastructure. This is where we see the transition from delicate experimental apparatus to robust, deployable machines people could actually use.
First, let's just nail down the essential components that define these early commercial instruments.
Yeah.
You obviously need the microphone or transmitter to speak into.
And the earphone or receiver to hear the voice coming back.
Right. And for decades, these would often be separate elements, maybe later combined into a somewhat bulky handset.
Now, early on, there wasn't just one way to build these, was there?
No, diversity reigned for a bit. Some inventors, including Bell himself initially, favored what are called dynamic variants. These are devices where a diaphragm vibrates a coil of wire in a magnetic field, generating the electrical current itself. Kind of elegant, actually.
Self-powering, in a sense.
In a sense, yes. But what ultimately won the early commercial war, despite some technical drawbacks, was the carbon transmitter.
Okay, this sounds important, especially for understanding the business side. Most early commercial phones adopted this carbon or graphite granule transmitter, patented by people like Thomas Edison and Emil Berliner. Why did this design beat out Bell's own preferred dynamic method?
One word, loudness. Pure and simple loudness.
Oh.
The carbon transmitter worked differently. It packed tiny carbon granules between two metal plates. When you spoke, the sound waves caused pressure variations on the diaphragm, which varied the compactness of those granules. This change in compactness altered the electrical resistance of the circuit passing through the granules. This resistance variance resulted in a much stronger, much louder electrical signal being modulated, sometimes 10 times louder, even more than the dynamic variance.
Okay, so the carbon transmitter gave you much better volume. That would be crucial for noisy city environments or sending signals down long, potentially poor quality lines back then. But there was a trade-off, right? It wasn't self-powering. It needed more components, like an induction coil.
It did. It needed a local power source, usually a battery, and it absolutely required an induction coil. The coil acted as an impedance-matching transformer. Without getting too deep into the physics, this component essentially boosted the voltage and adjusted the signal's electrical properties to better match the impedance of the long telephone line. It made sure that the lovely, loud signal generated by the carbon transmitter didn't just fizzle out after a short distance. And here's a really key nugget for you. Those Edison and Berliner patents on the superior carbon transmitter. They were acquired or controlled by Bell's company and were fiercely protected in court for years. Because the carbon transmitter was just commercially superior due to its loudness, holding these patents allowed the Bell Telephone Company to maintain its effective monopoly well into the 20th century, even after some of Bell's original foundational patents began to expire.
Wow. So competitors were basically forced to use inferior, quieter technology.
For quite a while, yes. The network became powerful, not just because of its scale, but because it owned the essential high-performance component technology that made the service truly usable and desirable for the average person.
That's a fascinating insight. The monopoly wasn't just the initial invention, it was controlling the practical improvements too. And think about the logistical nightmare of actually powering these early phones. You mentioned they needed a local power source.
Initially, yes, they were locally powered. This meant either using those dynamic transmitters, which generated their own weak power but were often too quiet, or much more commonly, especially with the carbon transmitters, they relied on a local battery. Often these were big, messy, wet cell batteries located right at the subscriber's premises.
So someone had to maintain these.
Imagine the labor cost. Outside plant personnel, linemen, had the constant job of traveling to every single telephone periodically just to inspect, service, or replace those individual batteries. It was immensely inefficient and expensive.
That sounds like a constant, colossal drain on resources. The shift to a common battery system must have been a true revolution then.
Absolutely. It was huge. By the early 20th century, engineers figured out how to power all the phones on an exchange from one large, reliable battery system located at the central office itself. The power was sent out over the same two wires that carried the voice signals. This common battery system streamlined maintenance enormously. No more house calls for battery changes. And it made the phone much more reliable for the user, as they no longer had to worry about their local battery running dry mid-conversation.
Now, before that centralization, the setup was just kind of absurd looking back. You said subscribers initially leased phones in pairs.
Right, and they had to hire a contractor themselves to build a direct line between their two desired locations, say, home to shop.
So if you wanted to talk to 10 different people or businesses,
you needed 10 separate direct lines installed, 10 pairs of wires crossing city streets, running over rooftops, strung on poles. It was completely unscalable.
A tangled mess waiting to happen.
Exactly. That quickly became untenable. Companies like Western Union, which already had experience with central telegraph exchanges, and Bell's company rapidly adopted the centralized switchboard model. This replaced those messy, inefficient, point-to-point connections with a system where every subscriber connected to a central hub, the exchange. And human operators physically plugged in patch cords on a big board to connect the calling party to the called party.
And even just getting the operator's attention. How did you signal them in those very first days, before the bells?
If you can believe it, initially, you literally had to alert the other end, or the exchange operator, by whistling loudly and directly into the transmitter.
You're kidding. Just whistle.
Yep. Imagine that. trying to whistle loud enough and at the right pitch to maybe trigger something on the far-end receiver or get the operator's ear. It quickly proved pretty unreliable, as you can guess.
I can imagine. What replaced the whistle?
Very quickly, the electric bell housed in a separate unit often called the ringer box. Early on, this might have required extra wires just for signaling. But clever engineers soon developed ways to use the same two-wire line for both talking and ringing. They typically incorporated a capacitor in series with the bell coil.
Okay, how did that help?
Well, the capacitor would block the low-voltage DC current that powered the phone when it was on hook for talking, so the bell wouldn't ring constantly. But it would allow the high-voltage AC ringing signal, sent from the exchange, to pass through and activate the bell. Pretty smart engineering.
Very clever. Now, speaking of complex wiring, let's touch on the nightmare of early automation. We tend to associate automated dialing with those sleek rotary mechanisms, but the first attempts to replace human operators were, well, mechanical monstrosities.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about the Strauger automatic exchange. It was famously invented by Almon Strauger, who was an undertaker of all things.
Undertaker? Why?
The story goes, he suspected a rival undertaker's wife, who worked as a switchboard operator, was intentionally diverting his business calls to her husband's funeral home.
Okay, that's some motivation.
Right. So he invented this complex electromechanical switch to bypass the operators altogether. His mechanical solution, while it worked, required whopping 7 wires running to each phone in its early iterations.
7 wires for just one telephone line? Why on earth so many?
Because the system needed separate electrical paths to communicate all the different states and commands involved in setting up a call automatically back then. You needed wires for the speaking loop itself, of course, but also separate wires for things like operating a knife switch, for sending pulses from telegraph keys or push buttons to step the mechanical selectors, and for the bell circuit. It was this intricate electromechanical beast designed to replicate step by step what the human operator did.
Wow. Thankfully, technology quickly reduced that complexity down to just 2 wires, plus maybe a ground return, and later the standard 2-wire loop we used for decades.
Definitely. But let's not overlook the absolute grit and resourcefulness shown in rural areas, especially in America. For farming communities or remote places not connected to those fancy new common battery exchanges in the city.
They relied on something different, right? The magneto.
Exactly. They used a magneto hand crank generator built right into the phone set.
The sound of that crank is iconic in old movies.
It is. You had to physically turn it vigorously. This generated a high-voltage AC signal, powerful enough to ring the bells of all the other phones connected on the shared party line, or to get the attention of the operator at a small rural exchange. That cranking sound really signaled urgency and connection out in the countryside.
And you mentioned something incredible in the outline. The use of barbed wire telephone lines. Is that real?
Oh, absolutely. It's the definition of technological improvisation and grit. Farmers simply exploited their existing fencing infrastructure. They'd use the long strands of iron barbed wire, already strung up for livestock, as makeshift telephone conductors.
Just connect the phones to the fence?
Essentially, yes, with some basic insulators. Now, the fidelity wouldn't have been great, lots of noise probably, but it allowed vital communication across farms and communities where string dedicated copper lines would have been completely unaffordable. That kind of resourcefulness is just totally lost in our age of fiber optics and satellites.
Truly amazing. Now, moving to the physical design of the instrument itself, the shift from a sprawling, multi-part apparatus to a more compact, user-friendly device was gradual.
It was. In the 1890s, we got that famous 3-part design. The candlestick phone, the transmitter stood upright on the column, the candlestick part.
And the receiver hung on the side.
Yes, on a crucial component, the switch hook.
Ah, the hook. That was more than just a place to hang the receiver, wasn't it?
Much more. The receiver's weight on the hook physically operated a switch inside the phone. Lifting the receiver closed the circuit to talk, hanging it up opened the circuit. This was a massive practical improvement over earlier designs that often had separate manual switches.
Because people would forget to flip the switch.
Constantly. They'd finish a call and just leave the phone electrically connected, leaving it off the hook. This would tie up the entire line, preventing anyone else, especially on a party line, from making or receiving calls. The switch hook made it nearly automatic to disconnect properly, much harder to accidentally leave the line engaged.
Simple but brilliant. Then came cradle designs.
Right, these soon followed. They combined the receiver and the transmitter into a single molded handle, what we now call the handset, which rested horizontally in a cradle base. This was generally more ergonomic and comfortable to hold for longer conversations.
But the look that really stuck, the one many people picture, is the classic old phone, solidified when?
That longest-lasting, most popular style really came together in the early 20th century, with sets like the Bell Systems Western Electric Model 202-type desk set. This is that iconic look. The carbon granule transmitter and the electromagnetic receiver merge into one single, usually black, molded plastic or bakelite handset, secured in a cradle base that contained the ringer and the network connection block.
And that design was so efficient, right? It incorporated the loudness of the carbon transmitter, the convenience of the switch hook,
and the comfort of the combined handset. It was a mature, effective design that persisted with internal electronic improvements for decades, really well into the 1950s and 60s as a standard form factor.
And finally, that overall system efficiency led to customer dialed service becoming widespread. The rotary dial, enabling users to call numbers directly without needing an operator for every single call, became commonplace in the 1930s and 40s.
Yes, although the tenacity of the older systems is legendary, you wouldn't believe how long some of those manual or magneto systems persisted.
Like that example from Maine.
Exactly. We have sources indicating that Bryant Pond, Maine, is famous for being the very last public exchange in the entire United States to finally convert from the old magneto hand crank system to modern direct dial service.
And when did that happen? Not the 50s or 60s?
Nope, 1983.
1983, wow. Imagine still cranking a phone when everyone else was well into using push-button phones, maybe even early cordless ones.
It's amazing. And the next huge technical leap was that push-button system. Touch tone signaling, officially called dual tone multi-frequency, or DTMF. AT&T introduced it commercially starting in 1963.
And this was faster than the rotary dial.
Much faster. It replaced the slow, clunky pulse dialing of the rotary system, where the dial sent out a series of clicks for each number with pairs of musical tones. Each button generated a unique combination of two frequencies. The central office equipment could decode these tones much quicker than counting pulses, dramatically improving the speed and ease of making a connection. It also enabled interaction with early computerized systems over the phone line.
Okay, now before we plunge headfirst into the digital era, you wanted to take a fascinating detour. Let's shift gears completely for section three, the specialized survivor sound-powered telephones.
Yes. This is a type of telephone that stands in stark contrast to almost the entire evolution we've just detailed, because it intentionally, by design, rejects all external power sources for the voice transmission itself.
Okay, what's the basic physics behind this? How on earth can the human voice alone generate enough electrical power to transmit a signal over potentially miles of wire?
It's a really wonderful, pure demonstration of Faraday's law of electromagnetic induction. These devices use what's called a moving coil microphone and a matching moving coil receiver. When you speak into the microphone, the sound waves from your voice physically vibrate a lightweight coil of wire that's suspended within the field of a powerful permanent magnet. That movement of the wire cutting through the magnetic field lines generates a tiny but measurable electrical current, and the power for that current comes solely from the acoustic energy of your voice hitting the diaphragm.
So literally, the energy of your breath, the sound waves, is the power source for the signal.
Exactly. That weak electrical signal then travels down the wire pair and hits the receiver on the other end. In the receiver, the incoming current flows through a similar coil in another magnetic field. This makes the receiver's coil vibrate back and forth in sync with the original voice signal.
And that vibration moves the receiver diaphragm, recreating the sound wave for the listener. Incredible.
It is elegantly simple and robust.
But wait, if there's no external battery or power from the line for the voice signal, how do they signal the other station? You can't whistle into these. Surely you need something stronger to ring a bell or make a noise?
Correct. They rely on a separate, dedicated hand-cranked magneto generator, very similar in principle to the ones used in those old farm phones we talked about. This magneto is built into the phone set and is used only for signaling. Cranking it generates a strong, high-voltage AC current designed specifically to activate a loud buzzer, sometimes called a howler or a growler, at the receiving station. So voice is self-powered, signaling needs the crank.
What I find really remarkable is their operational range. Despite using just the minuscule power from the voice, our sources indicate that these systems, even using standard 1 millimeter core diameter twisted pair copper wiring, can operate reliably up to 48 kilometers or about 30 miles apart.
That is staggering reliability and distance for a completely self-powered voice system. And that absolute reliability is the sole reason they still exist and are manufactured today.
So where are they used? What are the critical applications?
They're used in situations where power loss is not just a possibility but can be catastrophic, and communication must be maintained at all costs. They're considered indispensable in places like airport control towers, railway signal boxes, mining operations, especially underground, chemical plants, oil and gas facilities, and military arsenals.
And there's a safety aspect too, right? Because they operate at such low voltages for the voice part.
Exactly. The voice circuit operates at extremely low voltages and currents. This makes them inherently suitable, intrinsically safe, for use in environments where there's a high risk of explosion or fire, like in certain chemical processes or fuel handling areas. You avoid introducing potentially spark-inducing high-voltage electrical equipment into a hazardous zone.
And you mentioned naval vessels use them extensively.
Oh, critically. They are the absolute backbone of internal ship communication during emergencies, particularly for damage control coordination after battle damage. They're often referred to as the sound-powered phone system or the damage control circuit, like the JA circuit of the U.S. Navy. They operate completely independently of the ship's main electrical grid. And naval designers often run auxiliary, heavily protected, dedicated wiring circuits just for these sound-powered systems throughout the ship. The goal is to ensure that even significant battle damage is unlikely to completely disable internal command communication. They are the ultimate, dependable, last-resort communication tool.
From that kind of primitive, pure elegance of sound-powered systems, we now have to make the jump into the era of exponential complexity. Let's get into Section 4, the digital transition and the massive VoIP disruption.
This is where things really accelerate. The invention of the transistor back in 1947 at Bell Labs fundamentally changed every aspect of telecommunications over the following decades. It shifted the entire technological focus from electromechanical relays, those clicking switches, to solid-state electronics. This paved the way for the digital age and telephony.
And these were massive technological shifts happening in the background, often invisible to the end user initially. Things like stored program control. What did that mean for the phone network?
Stored program control meant the central office switch, the exchange, was no longer a giant, complex, physical, mechanical maze of wires and relays that had to be physically rewired to change routing. It became essentially a computer running software.
So changes could be made by reprogramming.
Exactly. Much more flexible, powerful, and capable of offering new features. We also saw the introduction of MOS metal oxide semiconductor integrated circuits for electronic switching, making things smaller, faster, cheaper. And critically, perhaps the most important enabler for digital telephony was the widespread adoption of pulse code modulation, or PCM.
Okay, let's pause on PCM for a moment. This sounds fundamental. What is it?
PCM is the standard method used to convert analog voice signals, those smooth undulating waves Bell worked with, into digital data. It works by sampling the amplitude of the analog wave thousands of times per second, usually 8,000 times per second for standard voice. Each sample's amplitude is then measured and assigned a numerical value, which is then converted into a string of binary code, a pulse code, typically 8 bits per sample.
So you turn the smooth wave into a series of numerical snapshots.
Precisely. This digital signal, the stream of numbers, is vastly more resistant to noise, distortion, and interference during transmission compared to the original analog wave. You can regenerate it perfectly over long distances. This led to significantly improved voice quality, much higher capacity on the lines, you can multiplex many digital calls together, and ultimately lower networking costs.
This digital backbone, built using PCM, then set the stage for delivering unified digital services right to the end user. In the 1980s, we saw the launch of the Integrated Services Digital Network, or ISDN.
ISDN was really the first big commercial push to deliver an entirely digital connection, end-to-end, right to the customer's premises, replacing the old analog line. For businesses and some early tech-savvy consumers, it felt like a revolution because it allowed that single digital phone line to carry multiple channels simultaneously. You could have digital data, digital voice, maybe even basic video conferencing, and fax services all running at the same time over the same wires.
So it wasn't just about voice anymore.
Not at all. It was the true precursor to the high-speed broadband internet connections we rely on today. It proved fundamentally that voice was just another form of data that could be digitized and transmitted.
But the real disruptor, the technology that is actively dismantling that 100-plus-year-old traditional phone network infrastructure as we speak, was the ability to digitize voice and transmit it not over dedicated phone lines, but as real-time data packets across standard computer networks, especially the internet.
We're talking, of course, about Voice over Internet Protocol, or VoIP.
And VoIP is now dominant, isn't it?
Is rapidly replacing the traditional copper-based public switch telephone network, PSTN infrastructure worldwide. This isn't some future trend, it's the present reality. We saw its adoption surge quite early in tech-leading countries. Sources show that by as early as 2005, up to 10% of telephone subscribers in major markets like Japan and South Korea had already switched away from traditional lines to digital VoIP services.
And the financial implications are just staggering, right? The global VoIP market was valued at something like $85.2 billion back in 2021, and it's only grown. Why the massive shift?
Primarily cost efficiency. Sending voice calls as data packets over the internet, which shares infrastructure with all other internet traffic, is dramatically cheaper to operate and maintain than running millions upon millions of miles of dedicated copper wire circuits just for voice. This economic reality is driving the widespread retirement of copper infrastructure by telcos globally. They want everyone onto the fiber-based digital networks.
And IP telephony has led to a whole range of different equipment people might use now.
Yes, there's diversity. If you want to keep your old, familiar analog phone, you plug it into something called an analog telephone adapter, ATA. This little box digitizes your voice and connects to your internet router. Alternatively, you might get a dedicated IP phone, which looks like a regular office phone, but has an Ethernet port instead of a phone jack and connects directly to the network. Or, increasingly common, especially in business, you just use a computer soft phone application software on your PC or laptop with a headset.
But this massive digital shift, moving everything onto the internet and local networks, introduced a really crucial operational difference compared to the old, reliable analog system. And the safety stakes got significantly higher, didn't they?
That's probably the most critical takeaway for users to understand. Remember how those old analog phones, even the non-Magneto ones, were powered directly from the central office over the copper line?
Right, so they usually kept working even if your house lost power.
Exactly. Digital telephones, including VoIP routers, ATA adapters, IP phones, and the base stations for cordless phones connecting via VoIP, they all require a local power supply. They need to be plugged into your wall outlet. So if your local power goes out, your internet modem and router die, and so does your VoIP phone service. Unless, that is, you've taken the step of installing an uninterruptible power supply, UPS, battery backup for your essential network gear, that's a big difference in reliability during outages.
And the safety implication for emergency services like calling 911 or 999 or 112 is also profound.
Hugely important. Old fixed analog lines automatically transmitted the precise physical service address associated with that line to the emergency dispatcher. They knew exactly where you were calling from. Internet-based digital service, however, is tied to a network connection, an IP address, which isn't inherently fixed to a location. You could take your ATA adapter to a different house, plug it in, and potentially still make calls.
So 911 wouldn't know where you are?
Not automatically, no. It requires special provisions, enhanced 911 or E911 databases, and complex network mapping to accurately provide the caller's registered service location to emergency responders. Getting this system reliable and accurate globally has been a massive regulatory and technical challenge as VoIP adoption exploded.
And the evolution just continues, right, with convergence into mobile networks?
Absolutely. The integration of voice directly into the mobile data networks through technologies like voice over LTE, VoLTE, and now voice over 5G, VoL5G, is making this digital shift basically complete, even when you're on the move.
If we were to simplify VoLTE for the listener, what are we really talking about?
We're talking about voice finally giving up its last dedicated circuit path. Traditionally, when you made a mobile call, even on early smartphones, the network often switched your call into a separate, older, circuit-switched voice channel, like falling back to 2G or 3G. With VoLTE, your voice call is treated just like any other data stream, like browsing the web or streaming video. It's broken into IP packets and transmitted entirely over the high-speed 4G LTE or 5G mobile data network.
So no more separate voice network needed on the phone.
Essentially, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the final step in dissolving that old century-long distinction between dedicated voice transmission and general data transmission. It's all just data now.
That sets us up perfectly for our final section, section 5, mobility cordless, cellular, and satellite. We start with the shortest jump to freedom from the wall.
The cordless phone.
Right. The cordless telephone solved that simple problem of short-range mobility within a home or maybe a small office. It consists of a base station that plugs into the phone line, which could be a traditional PSTN line or increasingly a VoIP connection from your router. and it communicates via radio frequency signals with one or more portable handsets.
And the range is usually just within the same building?
Generally, yes. Usually within a few hundred feet, depending on the technology, like DECT and obstructions.
The base station is kind of the control hub, then.
Exactly. It includes the radio transceiver to talk to the handset, often a hands-free speakerphone function itself, maybe a keypad, a display for caller ID, and frequently a built-in digital answering machine function. But note the constraint here. The base station itself requires a constant AC power supply from the wall outlet to function and also to recharge the batteries in the handsets when they're placed in their charging cradles. So it's still tethered to the house power, even if the handset itself gives you freedom to roam around the house.
Then we make the big leap into true wide area mobility with cellular networks and mobile phones. The core mechanism here is actually quite elegant. Conceptually, the mobile phone connects via radio transmissions not directly to another phone, but to a network of ground-based transmitter receiver stations, the cell towers or base stations you see everywhere, which are themselves interconnected and linked into the global telecommunications network.
And the timeline for the shift from niche to ubiquitous was incredibly fast, wasn't it?
Lightning fast in historical terms. The first analog cellular network started appearing commercially around 1979. Then the digital networks, standardized globally under the GSM standard primarily, arrived in the early 1990s. And each subsequent generation, 2G, 3G, 4G, and now 5G, has focused less and less on improving basic voice quality, which got pretty good with digital, and overwhelmingly on massively increasing data speeds and capacity.
And what defines your identity on this vast cellular network? It's not the phone itself, is it?
Not primarily. It's that tiny piece of plastic you usually insert, the SIM card, which stands for Subscriber Identity Module.
What's actually on that?
This small PVC card contains an integrated circuit chip that securely stores your unique International Robo Subscriber Identity, IMSI number, along with cryptographic keys. This IMSI is essential for identifying and authenticating you, or rather your subscription, to the mobile network. It's a profound shift conceptually. The phone number and service are no longer tied to a physical place, like the copper line ending in your house, but to this portable physical token, the SIM card, which represents your individual authenticated identity on the network. You can move it between compatible phones.
And beyond just making calls, these mobile phones, even before smartphones, rapidly expanded their features.
Massively. They gained LCD screens, then color screens, later OLED. Text messaging, SMS, became huge. Then came multimedia messaging, MMS, for sending pictures. They added basic calendars, calculators, simple games, then cameras, music players, and eventually rudimentary internet access via protocols like WAP.
This relentless expansion of features leads inevitably to the dominant device of our time, the smartphone era.
And the smartphone really is a true convergence point. It's fundamentally a powerful mobile phone and a pocket-sized personal computing device seamlessly integrated into one unit.
The interface changed dramatically, too.
Completely.
Mm-hmm.
It became primarily a graphical user interface, GUI, operated via a responsive touchscreen, allowing for much more intuitive interaction with complex functions. Text input moved almost entirely to on-screen virtual keyboards, though sometimes supplemented by secondary voice user interfaces like Siri or Google Assistant.
And the functionality just exploded thanks to apps. Right.
The concept of downloadable applications, or apps, from centralized app stores was the killer feature. This allowed the phone's capabilities to be extended almost infinitely by third-party developers. This enabled easy integrated video calling over IP connections, full-featured web browsing comparable to desktop computers, and the integration of sophisticated sensors that turned the phone into a powerful tool for navigation, GPS, photography, high-res cameras, motion sensing accelerometers, personal health tracking, and so much more.
And the business landscape was completely overturned by this, wasn't it? The old guard of phone makers.
They were disrupted massively. Before the smartphone really took hold, the market was dominated by traditional telecommunications specialists like Nokia, Motorola, Ericsson, maybe BlackBerry for business users. But once the iPhone arrived in 2007, followed quickly by Android devices, the primary manufacturer shifted towards consumer electronics giants, Apple, Samsung, Google, Xiaomi, and others. This really signaled the device's true nature. It had become a powerful, pocketable computer that happens to make phone calls, rather than just being a phone that happens to have a few extra computing features.
The adoption statistics you mentioned are just mind-blowing.
They really are. Our sources note that back in 2002, perhaps only about 10% of the world's population used mobile phones at all. By 2009, just 7 years later, there were nearly 6 billion mobile and fixed-line telephone subscriptions combined worldwide, with mobile subscriptions alone hitting 4.6 billion. The mobile device, and specifically the smartphone by the 2010s, had officially become the primary, most accessible, most personal communication and information access tool for a vast majority of humanity.
Okay, finally, before we wrap up, let's look at the absolute extreme edge of mobility, satellite phones or sat phones.
Right. A sat phone does what a cell phone does, connects you wirelessly for voice calls. But instead of talking to a nearby cell tower on the ground, it connects via a radio link directly up to communication satellites orbiting the Earth.
These could be geostationary satellites hovering way out, or constellations of satellites in lower Earth orbit, like Iridium or Starlink.
Exactly. Bypasses all the terrestrial cell sites and ground-based infrastructure completely.
And the huge advantage of that is
global or near global coverage. They can work in virtually any geographic location on the planet, middle of the ocean, polar regions, vast deserts, impenetrable jungles, provided you have a reasonably clear view of the sky to establish a line of sight link with the satellite.
This makes them absolutely indispensable for certain niche but critical applications where normal terrestrial infrastructure is completely non-existent or maybe destroyed.
Definitely. Think long-distance maritime shipping, scientific expeditions into the remotest parts of the globe, resource exploration and mining in undeveloped areas, and critical humanitarian aid missions in disaster zones.
And they also serve as a kind of ultimate backup, right, in emergencies.
Crucially, yes. They serve as a highly dependable communication tool during large-scale emergencies, natural disasters, or even conflict situations. Because the core infrastructure is orbiting safely in space, the communication link is rarely disrupted by local events on Earth, whether it's an earthquake or hurricane, or human actions like cutting terrestrial cables. For journalists, aid workers, military personnel, or anyone operating in unstable regions, a sat phone is often the ultimate insurance policy for maintaining that vital, distant voice capability when all else fails.
Okay, let's try and bring this incredible century and a half journey together. We have traced the distant voice from literally a shout through a megaphone,
all the way to a compressed packet of digital data traversing satellites in space and fiber optic cables under the oceans, probably reaching a device in your pocket that has more computing power than NASA used for the moon landing. It's quite a ride.
We can maybe synthesize this whole evolution into three major defining phases, couldn't we?
I think so. First, there was that messy, controversial, historical invention phase, the race to simply transmit any sound, then intelligible voice electrically. That was ultimately won, commercially and technologically, by Bell's revolutionary insight into the fluctuating current. That specific discovery separated the telephone fundamentally from the on-off world of the telegraph.
Say phase one, invention and the core tech. Phase two.
Phase two was the massive, decades-long challenge of building the infrastructure. This required inventing the switchboard for networking, figuring out efficient power systems, like moving from local batteries to common battery, fighting fierce patent battles over crucial improvements, like the louder carbon transmitter, and establishing reliable, durable, user-friendly physical formats for the phones themselves. Building the network.
And phase three, the modern era.
Phase three is the era of digital convergence and mobility. The total absorption of the telephone concept into the world of computing power. This involved moving the backbone from analog copper to digital fiber, transmitting voice as data packets using PCM and later VoIP IP, the massive disruption caused by internet telephony, and finally, the ultimate supremacy of the smartphone integrating voice seamlessly with video, messaging apps, and every other digital service we now rely on, all in a device you carry anywhere.
And the core insight that emerges from all that, for me, is how the phone fundamentally shifted from connecting places.
Right, a copper-based connection between two fixed physical points, like two houses or two offices.
See, connecting people. The phone number, or now maybe just your contact identity, is no longer permanently attached to a specific location or even a specific physical technology. It's attached to you, the individual, regardless of where you are or what device or medium you happen to be using to access the global network at that moment.
It has truly become the personalized, portable, digital distant voice, completely untethered. And maybe here's a final thought for you to chew on as we conclude this deep dive. We noted early on that inventors like Reese used intermittent currents, which sounded kind of like a buzzing telegraph signal. And Bell's huge innovation was the smooth, continuous analog fluctuating current, that wave-like signal. That was the pivotal break from the digital-like past of the telegraph.
Okay.
Yet, think about modern digital telephony, especially VoIP, VoLTE, Vo5G. What are they doing? They are breaking the continuous sound wave back down into discrete, distinct packets of digital data for transmission, ones and zeros. Now, in a purely technical sense, transmitting voice is non-continuous, separate, discrete packets. It's functionally actually much closer in form to those old, intermittent telegraphic impulses than it is to Bill's smooth, continuous, undulating analog wave. We've got to come full circle, back to packets, albeit vastly more complex ones.
Well, never thought it that way.
So, consider this. Is the smartphone, this incredible slab of glass and silicon, the final, ultimate evolution of the telephone? Or is it merely the current, most convenient host for the underlying distant voice concept? Is it just waiting for the next technological medium to come along, perhaps something even more integrated or biologically connected, that will break down communication into yet another, even more efficient digital format, potentially rendering our sleek glass devices just as quaint as a candlestick phone seems to us today? Something to perhaps ponder next time you use your supercomputer phone to, you know, just check a map or stream some music.
That's a fantastic thought to end on. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the secret life of the telephone. We certainly hope you feel significantly more well-informed about the history and technology packed into the device that links us all.